Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre and this is Green Planet FM. And today I'm going to talk about debt and some of the solutions. The McKinsey Institute says global debt is now $199 trillion and unsustainable. That was in May 2015. That means that global debt is $27,204 US for every person living today. That, to me, is unbelievable. In New Zealand, we're allowing our children to go into debt slavery. First, they have student loans, then they may have a mortgage, and then they're supposed to save for their retirement. If we continue with this system, we will fail as a society. So I have asked into the studio today Don Richards from Positive Money New Zealand to talk to us today about this very concerning situation. But first I'd like to say, the present monetary system ensures a rapidly widening income gap. It is literally enslaving us with debt. The banking system is inherently unstable and actually creates recessions. That results in an increase in unemployment and destroys otherwise sound businesses. The financial system that is enslaving us gets its power from our consent. The vast majority of money is created by private sector banks out of thin air, and then we pay interest on that. And Don was actually on television interviewed about how the banks create money out of thin air. So we'll hear from him shortly. Each time a bank makes a loan, it's essentially creating money as debt. This system results in problems such as increasing levels of household debt and inflating property prices. Now, Don's going to talk about a sovereign money system. And that gives us a better and safer banking system, economic stability, reduced dependence on debt, supporting the real economy, more effective monetary policy, better government finances, tackling unaffordable housing, there's a big one for Auckland, and slowing the rise in inequality and improving democracy. So those are some major things that we would like to see happen, of course. And Don today will talk about this. So welcome, Don. To explain all this, can you tell me, what is positive money? How does this affect all that I've spoken about? And how did you get into this?
Well, first, Lisa, thank you very much for inviting me along. And I think the name positive money sort of indicates what it's all about. Our current monetary system is debt-based. That is, for money to be introduced into the system, into the economy, it must first be created as debt. And we call that debt money, really. And our solution is to have the government create it, interest and debt-free, so that it can be spent on infrastructure projects, and that will enliven and revitalise our economy. So that's positive money in a nutshell. The idea came from the UK, Positive Money UK. Ben Dyson set it up about 5 years ago. And we learned about the system through watching The Secret of Oz, a very good documentary by Bill Still. First of all, we were a bit confronted by the enormity of what was going on, but then we approached Positive Money UK and asked them if we could set up a sister group here in New Zealand. At that time, Ben Dyson said, yes, that's great. And he provided us with the content of his website, which we customised for New Zealand. And we then started off with Positive Money New Zealand.
And so the whole essence of this is that the banks create money out of thin air, and then we pay interest on what they got for nothing.
That's it. Yes, that's it. And it creates all sorts of distortions in the economy. Firstly, those that have money can actually create a lot more money through prudent investing. Those that don't have money find themselves getting poorer and poorer. And we've found that the middle class, effectively, is being disempowered, disenfranchised, and they're losing a lot of their equity as well. It's a parasitic system that is actually killing the host, that is killing the New Zealand economy. And for it to succeed, more people need to get into debt than actually get out of it.
And this is pretty much worldwide. The whole system stinks, basically.
It does, yeah. There are a few isolated pockets where the system doesn't operate like this, like with the Islamic banking system, but the majority of economies in the West have this similar situation.
Well, the Islamic banking system, they don't believe in usury. In other words, they don't believe in paying interest on money. But are there any countries that actually apply that? Is Iran one of them?
Well, they do apply it, but there is a administration fee. So they have to charge something to manage the manage the investment, but it's not the very large amounts of compounding interest that we have here.
And so, I mean, it is interest. I mean, that's the big problem, isn't it? It's the worst thing.
Yes, it is. It is because if you have a mortgage, you may end up paying 2 to 3 times the amount of the principal in interest. I mean, if your mortgage stretches over 20, 25 years, then you'll end up paying 2 to 3 times the amount of the principal simply in interest.
So, like in Auckland, where house prices are ridiculous, and you buy a $700,000 house, you could be paying...
About $2 million worth of interest, and you're struggling to pay off the principal as well.
Yes. So, I mean, that's... Why buy a house?
Well, that's it. But it seems to be, irrespective of how high the prices go, people will always manage to find a way to come up with the funds. It's getting harder and harder, and a lot of investors are buying up multiple houses, so they're taking over the lead from the established home buyers, and it's virtually impossible for new home buyers to enter the market.
Yes, yes. So, and the key to that is actually not, oh, we haven't got enough houses, or, oh, we've got horrible overseas investors. It's actually that the banking system is corrupt, essentially, and making masses of money out of, you know, unjustly. And so we need to do something about it. But, you know, if you talk to people generally, they don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know that it's corrupt. It's unsustainable, and there's nothing that says you can't do it. It's not illegal, but there's no enabling legislation to say they can. So there's been a loophole in the law going back to 1960 when the Crimes Act was originally passed. It was illegal to create money. The Reserve Bank was the only institution that could create money, which was back then the notes and coins you found in your pocket. But now the system has gone digital with electronic banking, and due to this loophole, banks are now creating money out of nothing, entering it into your bank account through their computer, and then you're paying compounding interest on money the banks don't have. And it's allowed house prices to continue through the roof, if you excuse the euphemism, and it's simply because there's no constraint on the banks for how much they can lend out. It's only how much people can actually afford to pay. And when I say afford, it's not affordable anymore. But unless you buy now, things will never be cheaper, albeit rather expensive cheaper. And so we seem to be hardwired for we must buy now, because even though it's unpalatable, it'll be worse in 6 months' time. but it's,
maybe Auckland's at the moment has just levelled off a little bit, which is quite nice.
Well, I think it's just taking a breather before the next hike. But it's interesting, they talk about demand, but you remember in 2005, 2006, net migration in New Zealand, there was 35,000 people leaving New Zealand a year, and yet housing prices continued to increase at 8% per annum, even when we had this huge exodus of people. So it really isn't necessarily driven by supply and demand. And there was a very interesting article in the Herald by Brian Gould, who said that banks' ability to create money is what is driving up house prices.
But nobody took him up on that. The Labour Party, for example, didn't say this is the case. The Green Party in the UK, they actually have taken on Positive Money's solutions, as have has the Awareness Party in New Zealand, of course. And so, you know, there's some people out there saying, yes, we can fix this, but not anybody who's got enough influence.
Yeah, there are areas overseas. The Green Party in the United States is also taking it on. And I understand that New Zealand First passed a remit at their last conference, saying that they would take on money creation. Now, that hasn't formally been endorsed, but it's a step in the right direction, as is the Awareness Party.
Well, that's good. And for New Zealand First, yes, let's actually see you put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because earlier on, after the Christchurch earthquake, Russell Norman from the Green Party, who I'd spoken to, suggested that the funds for the EQC, Earthquake Commission, be topped up through money created by the Reserve Bank. And it was laughed out of Parliament.
I remember.
And so what they did was they actually went to the banks who created the money out of thin air and then charged the government interest on the money that they'd created, rather than the government doing it themselves.
And it looks like we'll have the same situation in Kaikoura, which is crazy because for infrastructure especially, and it's government is requiring this, why doesn't the government create the money for it?
Well, it's interesting again that we did this in the 1930s. Back in 1936, the first Labor government had the Reserve Bank create money to build state houses and also use the money for planting of Kaikoura State Forest. And so it's been done in the past, and that set the platform for pensions and the welfare state, stage two. And New Zealand emerged from the first Great Depression sooner and in better condition than any other, almost any other country in the world. America had to wait for World War II before its production could get going. And Canada actually had a similar situation back until the 1970s. They used the Central Bank of Canada to finance large infrastructure projects. The St. Lawrence Seaway, which is one of the wonders of the modern world, was financed through money created by the Bank of Canada. They used it for major highways, for subways, all sorts of infrastructure projects. And it's actually part of the constitution of the Canadian state that the Central Bank of Canada is to make money available to the provinces and to the cities for infrastructure projects. Unfortunately, things sort of got turned around with the Rogernomics, Thatcheronomics, Reaganomics, neoliberal U-turn in the 1970s, and all that valuable money has now been tagged with interest by private banks.
So, really, New Zealand's in a good position to solve this problem because we have a reserve bank that is, attached to the government. Some countries don't have that, do they? They're entirely dependent on private banking.
That's true. Yeah, that is true. And you're right, we are in a good position. We have a stable government. We are respected. And we've done it before. So we are in a very good position to actually take this on. Unfortunately, the current government is led by a merchant banker. And I have attempted to speak to Bill English, and he's refused to talk to me. National is the only party that we've approached that has refused point blank to talk to us. All correspondence has been returned. But we have received better hearings from other parties, but it's been disappointing. Labor, we got a good hearing from Labor, and I even went to speak to Grant Robertson and explained what we were up to, and he said, oh, that would take a courageous move on anyone's behalf. And I said, well, think back 130 years ago, Kate Shepherd probably came into a similar Wellington electoral MP's office and said, I want votes for women. And he would probably have said, oh, that sounds a bit courageous. So it will take courage. But unfortunately, we don't have anyone with that level of courage at the moment.
I think Labour probably is the closest in that they're considering a universal basic income after the election. They don't want to consider it before, just in case it could be too courageous and might look too bad. But a universal basic income for people's how people survive day to day isn't exactly positive money, but it does go hand in hand with it, the idea does.
Well, it's a way of redistributing the wealth in an even-handed way. But even with the universal basic income, the Labor government will actually be funding it either through taxes or through borrowings or through cutting services. And we say you don't have to do any of those. There is more than enough money available right now, and once our program is instituted, taxes will come down, social services will be enhanced, and the economy will grow without the need to cut back on any services.
Well, if the government creates its own money, then it can have a universal basic income, and then of course people have more disposable income to put back into the economy.
Yes, that's right. It's what you call an enclosed monetary system. And currently our financial system is more like a gaping wound. Money is created by private overseas banks and lent at interest. The profits then get repatriated overseas, $5,000 million at the last financial year. And the money that is lent out once it's repaid is what is called destroyed. So because the money is created, the principal is created from nothing, it returns to nothing. So the parasitic nature of our economy says that more people need to get into debt than pay off their debt for our economy to grow. And so this is why we've got this horrible growth imperative. We must grow. We must compromise our scruples, our environment. We engage in risky practices such as fracking, mining in our national estate, all that sort of thing, to grow the economy. You don't need that growth imperative if the government creates our money supply. The money stays in circulation within New Zealand and it grows organically.
And so we have, I mean, it's so logical, and people don't understand this. People take one look at the whole world situation and many just walk away and say, oh, good grief, politics, you know, I don't want to know about it. And so people don't know. TV3 did a short clip, was it after the 7 o'clock news one night? Of you talking about creating how the banks create money out of thin air. I think if you Google TV3...
It's banks, TV1, actually.
Was it TV1?
Yeah, TV1.
Oh.
Yeah, it was
okay.
Seven Sharp.
Mm.
Yes, and it's creating money, the banks creating money they don't have.
Is that what you'd Google?
Yes, that's right.
Right. And so, and they were quite amazed, I think, the people that researched that, quite amazed to find that there you had economists, respected economists, speaking on there, supporting what you had said. Rathmanji and who was the other gentleman?
Shemabel Jacob.
Yes. Who works at the university?
No, he's with, I think it's Burl, or he's with one of the major economic think tanks. So, sorry, Shemabel, if I've got the wrong think tank there. But he's pretty well respected, and he says, yes, of course, this is what we all learn year one economics. Banks create money out of thin air and then lend it out at compounding interest. And you were talking earlier about people finding out about it and not being interested. I think when I first found out about it, I thought surely there must be something else to it. I mean, if it was this simple, we'd have done it years ago. And so it was, I needed to hear the conversation a couple of times before it got in, because I was, no, that this can't be true. But I read the Chicago Plan Revisited, the IMF paper, which said that's exactly what happened, and it endorsed what we were saying around benefits of having money created by the government. And so then I decided, okay, now what? And that's where we took on Positive Money New Zealand. So we're an advocacy group, and we're here to let people know what's going on. We're part of an international movement. There are 18 such groups around the world, and there is a lot of different conversations going on. The Swiss are having a referendum next year on who creates their money. Now, if I was a betting man, I would have said the Swiss would be the last people to actually engage in that conversation, but they're actually going to be voting on should private banks create their money supply or should the government.
Well, they are a bit forward-thinking, because they had a referendum last year on a universal basic income, and they got quite a lot of support on that. So that would have woken people up to how money is created, because
yes,
the people pushing for the universal basic income, even though it didn't happen, it was still, you know, a lot of people voted for it.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of people, of course, requested it to get the referendum in the first place.
Yes.
So they might be waking up, and I believe that Germany's beginning to wake up as well.
I couldn't say about Germany, but I do know the issue has been debated in the British Parliament for the first time in over 160 years, and the Icelandic government has commissioned a paper from KPMG to look at the implications of governments creating their money supply. The Dutch have also, have I mentioned the Dutch?
No.
Ah, okay. The Dutch Parliament also have debated it. So this conversation is starting to gather momentum overseas. It's still pretty moribund, or pretty dead in the water here in New Zealand, but the more people hear about it, the more people we get saying there has to be an alternative.
Yes, and I mean, it's a bit like people don't really talk much about the buying and selling of money, and you're not taxed on that, whereas if you buy and sell potatoes, you're taxed on it. Now, why do we have different rules for money? So we need a Robin Hood tax, what's the other name for it? The Robin Hood tax.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of what the other name is. So that people who are buying and, you know, trading with money actually are taxed as well.
Well, you see, there's two separate economies going on in New Zealand. There's the financial or speculative economy, and there's the real economy. Now, the real economy is where products and services get created and jobs are created. And unfortunately, only 8%, I think it's 8 or 10% of the money in circulation gets invested into the real economy. The rest of it is put into the speculative economy, which is buying and selling houses. Now, we're never going to get rich buying and selling houses to each other, but over 90% of the money in circulation is used for that particular transaction. And we're talking also about farms. So, and it's simply because banks can create money out of thin air and then lend it to you and I, that they can push or they can allow house prices to carry on. Back when I was growing up, I mean, this was quite a while ago, we had trustee savings banks, and the amount that the banks needed to hold in reserve was a lot higher than it is today. I think it's about 8%. The banks need to have 8%, and then they can create the other 92% out of thin air. But so if your reserve is, say, 40%, then you're constrained by the amount of money you can attract. And so there was a constraint on the amount of available money to lend out. Therefore, there was a natural ceiling for house prices. Now the constraint is so low, there is little or no constraint. And so prices can increase as high as people are prepared to tie themselves to debt. And so we're looking at sort of 40, 50-year debts or even intergenerational debt. It's unsustainable. And I feel sorry for people entering university who are saddled with student loans. They finish their education with a debt that could be between $20,000 and $30,000. And then they're expected to save for a deposit, save for their retirement. And so they will be debt slaves to the banks for their entire life. And that's not a future I want for my children or grandchildren. So that's why my wife, Sue, and I have taken on this advocacy role. It's time people knew what's going on and said enough is enough.
And I do hope that the people listening to this are going to tell other people. Do you realise that the banks issue money out of thin air and charge interest on it? How fair is that? Well, that message needs to get out there.
Yeah, and further to that, the money in your account actually doesn't belong to you. So if you've got a bank account and you get your money credited, your wages credited to it, that money, once it enters your bank account, is no longer yours. It belongs to the bank, and the bank can do whatever they want with that money. So if there is a crisis, a run on the bank, you could lose all of your money.
Well, that's called, now there's a term for that, the open bank resolution, isn't it, in New Zealand?
Yes.
And it was passed only a couple of years ago, I believe. And the bank shareholders and creditors would shoulder the loss of any failing bank.
Yes, yes. Now,
that's not right.
Well, I mean, when you listen to it at first blush, okay, creditors and shareholders, they should shoulder some of the responsibility. But when you then realise that creditors is another way of saying people who have money deposited, their life savings, then it has a different spin on it. So if the bank, through its reckless spending, gets into trouble, then you will have to bail them out. Now, I know of no other business where if the business goes bankrupt, then everyone else pitches in to bring them out, because they will only get into this situation through reckless spending. And that's how the last global financial crisis came about. Highly, highly overpriced housing in America, and it fell over. Now, we have the same situation in Auckland. Highly, highly, highly overpriced housing. It will fall over. It's a matter of gravity. It's not if, it's a matter of when. And the bigger the bubble, the higher the fall.
Yes. So, and if the banks then fail, they'll take the money that we have saved in the bank to prop themselves up. Just like it happened in Greece, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it was Cyprus that had the run on the bank. Greece, that they managed to mortgage their future to the overseas banks and promised to pay all their assets, state assets, to the banks, and Yeah, it's virtually bankrupted them. But it's interesting, a similar thing happened in Iceland. They had some entrepreneurial risk takers who took over the banking system there. Highly, highly overpriced real estate. And it all fell over. And the Icelandic government said, well, you got yourself into this trouble, get yourself out of it. And they walked away. They actually said to the bank, you are a normal institution like any other. Sort it out. And so the Iceland economy is now in good shape. The Irish economy had a similar breakdown, but the Irish government, through their own choice, elected to stand behind the banks, and the Irish economy is in tatters. It is, for all intents and purposes, bankrupt. And they have selling off most of their state assets, and it's in dire trouble. The irony is the banks are now lending to Iceland because it's got a better credit worthiness. So this is what I talk about when I say the parasitic nature of the current situation. The banks can almost guarantee that whatever they do, the government will step in and help them out, because they're either too big to fail or the government doesn't understand the model and they think the banks are the only source of money.
And, of course, the banks, the US governments stepped in and rescued banks, didn't
yes.
they, at the taxpayers' expense
yes.
in the US. But they didn't say, oh, we're printing money to help and those sorts of things. They just gave it fancy names, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes.
Quantitative easing.
Yes, that's right.
So that people wouldn't really know quite what quantitative easing meant, but it was going to be the solution, so that'd do.
Well, the ridiculous thing was they borrowed the money to give to the banks, and then the banks lent that money out, in some instances, to... back to the government.
And the government paid interest on it.
That's right. That's right. And so the banks were awash with money, and the idea was that they would then lend that out to people who wanted to set up businesses. But the economy was so awash in debt that the notion of getting out of debt by taking on more debt is just ridiculous. So the banks had all this money, and they've been buying up overseas assets. They actually... took a share in Mighty River Power, I think, or one of the electrical companies that was privatised. The State Bank or the Federal Reserve Bank of New York bought a 5% share in one of our power companies. And the irony is here is that that power company was created by the tax for the normal citizens, and the money that the State Bank of New York or the Federal Reserve Bank of New York had was financed by the taxpayers in America, and they then used that money to buy up the asset, and the bank is benefiting from it.
So it's then become private money.
Yeah, it's then become private money. Yes,
yes, that's very typical of what's happening in a number of places. So going back to, well, I'll just say I'm interviewing Don Richards, and this is Green Planet FM, and Don is representing Positive Money New Zealand, which he started here with his wife Sue, and we're really concerned about how the crazy financial system is affecting all New Zealanders, and even on a world scale, just as I said at the beginning, that we have massive debt. If you think of, say, an African maybe in the desert, or a very, very poor person in Asia, and then you realise that actually the total global debt is 27,204 for every person living today. That means that the West has made an awful mess for the whole world, basically. Mm. And you had some other figure, didn't you?
Well, that level of global debt is 1.5 times the global GDP. So I can't actually get my hand around the fact that we owe more than the planet is worth. So the planet is virtually bankrupt, and the nature of the system is that it will continue to increase the level of debt. So there is a image I could actually share with you to actually explain how the system works or doesn't work. Just consider for a moment that our economy is like a bath, and money gets introduced into the economy by way of debt. That is, private banks create debt and they lend it out to you and I as mortgages.
And that's the water coming in the tap.
That's right. So that then sits around in the bathtub. And the problem is that once the loan gets repaid, that money is destroyed. So that money then goes out the hole in the bathtub. So you've got money coming in and money going out, and there's a bit of money in the bathtub, which is what we use to get by on.
So it's about half full.
Well, I'd say it's generous.
Half empty.
It's half full, half empty. I'd say it's a bit worse than that. Anyway, so when confidence in the economy dries up, fewer people take on new loans, so the amount of money coming into the economy reduces. More people pay off their loans, so the money that gets destroyed disappears down the tap. And so the money that's left in the bath is, say, a quarter full. Now, governments make things worse by introducing austerity measures, cutting back. So we somehow scrimp and get by on that reduced level of money in the economy. Now, when confidence starts to pick up again, more people take on debt than repay the debt, and so money in the bath increases. And so that's what you call the boom-bust cycle, and it happens every 10 years. And a side effect of that is lots and lots of businesses, houses, families, lives get destroyed by this cyclical boom-bust scenario. So our job, our solution, is to simply put the plug in the bath. That is, money that is created and introduced into the bath is done by the Reserve Bank, and it is sovereign money.
So that's why it's called a sovereign money system.
That's right. Mm. A positive money or sovereign money system. So then the money, once repaid, stays in circulation. It doesn't disappear down the bathtub. So the amount of money in the economy then grows and grows. And with more money in the economy, there will then be more money for taxes. And so then that actually feeds back into the bathtub. And so you could have an organic economy that grows consistent with the amount of people and the demand. And it would certainly put a brake on the affordability of housing. Housing would become affordable. People would have more money in their pockets. And the government would have more money to spend on social programs. They wouldn't have to go to the banks to lend money for infrastructure projects, such as light rail for Auckland or rebuilding Kaikoura. That money is there. It's available. The government just hasn't stepped up and said, yeah, we'll do it that way.
Right. And of course, with our current government, with John Key, who has worked in America in the banking system, it's absolutely not going to happen, any sort of change. But, you know, the more we can approach other political parties and persuade them to take note and say, look, we've got to change this.
Well, I would say
the more it's out in the conversations there more.
I would say, Lisa, that political parties are a bit, they lack a bit of backbone at the moment. They won't do anything unless there's votes in it for them. So we've approached all of the political parties. We even spoke to Hone Arawira. Lots of understanding, bit of sympathy, no action. Russell Norman was the only person who did anything, and all credit to him. All credit to him. And it's very frustrating to see the Green Party not taking this up, because this will put a nail in the coffin of the growth imperative. We will no longer need to engage in fracking. We will no longer need to mine in our national parks.
Or have oil drilling off the coast.
Yes, that's right. That's right. The growth imperative will disappear. We will have an economy that grows organically, and there will be more than enough money. Now, this is just not a message for the left or the fringes. If the governments on the right took it over, they could then use that extra money to reduce taxes or pay down the national debt. On the left, you could use it for social spending. You could eliminate the need for student loans. And we could have a universal basic income. So there are options. We're not saying which one's the best. We're not saying which ones you should do. We're just saying here are the options. It is a simple matter of updating the Crimes Act and saying only the Reserve Bank can create money in the forms of notes, coins and digital finance.
And it wouldn't stop local currencies from operating hand in hand with that, because there'd be no problem.
No, that's right. That's right. So the if there are the time banking, the local currencies, the green dollars, that sort of thing. And there would still be a role for the banks. The banks would still act as intermediaries, but they would only lend out the money they had on deposit. Your wages would go to a centrally administered fund at the Reserve Bank, and then the local branches would charge an account fee to actually allow you to draw on that money, you know, with your direct automatic payments and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, they charge account fees now.
That's right. That's right. And so the money would be guaranteed and saved. It would be your money. It would be available. And if you wanted to put money at risk or invest, then you could go to the banks and say, yes, I want to invest with you. And they could then use that money for mortgages.
So overall, that's eventually going to reduce inequality, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because money will be kept in circulation within New Zealand and businesses will thrive because people will have more money in their pockets. The government will not be paying millions, tens of millions, billions of dollars a year to the banks. And so the economy will thrive, and so everyone will benefit. Just imagine, you know, like if Fonterra has a good year, there's another billion dollars pumped into the economy, and that creates all sorts of flow-on effects. Well, imagine if the government could pump in $10 billion each year, year in, year out. Imagine what it would have the impact on our economy. Raf Manji, an economist, called it monetary dialysis. It would get the toxic money, the debt money, and flush it out of the system, and then this sovereign or positive money would then enliven the host rather than the parasitic debt-based money, which is actually killing the host.
And it'd actually create more economic stability.
Oh, yeah. Well, the boom-bust cycle would disappear, and that's what the IMF paper said. It said that the boom-bust cycle will be smoothed out over time with no impact on fiscal policy or inflation. So you'd have a stable economy. People would be able to plan ahead for a continuation of the steady state rather than plan ahead for, oh, when's the next recession going to come along?
More security, basically.
Yes.
And it's more security comes about from supporting the real economy.
Yes, that's
rather
right.
Rather than, the banking.
The speculative sector. Financial economy, because that money disappears overseas in repatriated bank profits, or the principal gets destroyed once the loan is repaid. So this is unsustainable, and the only way it can continue is for more people to get in debt than pays the debt off. Now, that is just a crazy system. And Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, said of all the ways of creating banking, the worst is the one we have today. So he's just said the system we have now is hopeless.
And it actually wasn't created as a system, really, was it? It's something that sort of evolved over time, and the greedy have grabbed it.
Well, opportunist slash. Sure, it started off in the 1600s and, 1700s, 1640 or so, when the Bank of England was originally created. And it's just over time it's got bigger and bigger and more speculation. Because in the, the beginning of the 20th century, you just had housing and land, but now you've got mortgage swaps, you've got derivatives, you've got all manner of speculation on speculation on speculation. And there are trillions of dollars being exchanged for no asset being produced, no income being taxed, and it's a huge hole, an arterial bleed in our economy, and we're focusing on the small change. We're making sure the beneficiaries get pinged, or we're stopping students from flying out of New Zealand, arresting them at the airport. This is crazy.
If they haven't paid their student loans.
Yeah, and yet the merchant bankers and the financiers and whatever can throw honest, hard-working people out of their homes, repossess their farms through little or no fault of their own, and they get knighthoods.
Yes.
It's the whole system is needs to be turned on its head.
Can you explain, you used the word derivatives before, can you explain derivatives to the listeners?
Well, I wish I could, because it's one of those things, the closer you look at it, the less sense it makes. But basically, it's you're betting on a certain outcome. So if the price of wheat's going to go up, you will bet, or you will get a derivative that say that the price of wheat will go up by this much. And if it does, you get money. If it doesn't, you lose. And so that's another form of speculation. And
so banks are doing this because they're putting money into their chosen businesses. So they are speculating on that, basically.
Yeah.
And if I give an example, the Bank of America has a lot of money in Lockheed Martin that manufactures weapons and nuclear weapons.
Mm.
And they are putting money in there because they see that technology has made some of these weapons obsolete, so they have to build new ones. And, of course, that is, you've got a big bank like the Bank of America wanting to do this. So they don't want to see a stable, peaceful world. They want to see a world where there is war, because that's going to make them more money.
Well,
basically.
Well, a war is very financially rewarding for certain sectors of the economy. New Zealand really didn't have much of a derivative market until recently. I think dairy products and wheat, I think, or some products are now able to be bought and sold through the derivative market. It's not huge here in New Zealand, but overseas it dwarfs the real economy.
Well, I spoke to the head of the Cooperative Bank a couple of years ago, and I said, what is your situation with derivatives? Do you engage in doing that? And they said, just a little bit. So even the banks that we think are the banks that have got it right still are slightly exposed to derivatives.
Yes, and when I'm talking about banks creating money out of thin air, Kiwi Bank does it, the Cooperative Bank does it, TSB does it. So basically, if you're banking with those banks, you're being ripped off by Kiwis. Still, they create money out of thin air and then they lend it to you at compounding interest.
So, you know, that people who are very smug and say, oh, well, you know, I bank with Kiwi Bank, you're actually not much better.
Well, you're slightly better off because that money stays within New Zealand. It just doesn't, the profits don't disappear overseas. Credit unions, they're the only institutions that actually lend out the money they have on deposit. Unfortunately, credit unions have their money with some of the private banks, so whilst they their funds will be stable, the funds in the bank may not be. And when we talk about Australian-owned banks, that's actually a misnomer. The Australian banks are owned by the American banks and the British banks. So you could call them Australian-based banks, but not necessarily Australian-owned banks. So if America has another large recession and the UK, and it falls over, they will drag the Australian banks with them, and New Zealand will be dragged down as well. And our situation here is pretty dire. Our debt, private debt, is very high, and our government debt is getting out of hand. So
yes, there's a website you can go to where you can see the New Zealand government debt getting larger and larger. Do you know what that one is?
I don't know, sorry.
No, but it is massive. Since in the last, 9 years, really. Hmm. The Labour government actually got the debt down under Helen Clark, and then since under John Key, it's just grown massively.
Yeah, well, I think it was about 10 million. Now it's about 10 billion, sorry. 10 billion. Now it's about 90 billion. And I'd like to know where that money's gone, because it didn't really go on Christchurch, because the Christchurch City Council has been asked to sell off their assets to fund it. I would say, being generous, that maybe 10 billion of that 90 billion may have gone on Christchurch, but where did the other 80 billion go?
It is a bit crazy. I saw a little Kiwi Bank advertisement, which I guess they couldn't use on the television, and it was rather good, and it showed a group of people who'd been gathered together by marketers in Australia, and they said, we're going to create a bank, and this is an Australian bank, you know, but the only thing is, we're going to put all the profits into New Zealand. And everybody in the room, of course, said, oh, rubbish, you know, we wouldn't bank with a bank that would put all its profits overseas. And then at the end it said that this Kiwi Bank doesn't do that. The profit stays in New Zealand.
Yes.
So it was, you know, a setup, but it was very interesting the way it was done, that you know, it was showing these people with the Aussie accent saying, no way would we allow our money to go elsewhere. But somehow there's a feeling out there that the powers that be look after us, but they don't.
Yeah, well, I think that's diminishing over time, because with this neoliberal drive, it's the market will look after everyone, and people have to take personal responsibility for their own actions. But if the market is being driven by a parasitic banking system, which means more people need to get in debt than get out of debt, then it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get worse.
I think that's a very good way of explaining it, that it's a parasitic banking system that makes its money by people getting into debt.
Yes.
When you put it like that, people must understand.
Well, yeah, let's hope so.
Yeah. So how can people find out more about Positive Money, Don?
Well, just Google Positive Money New Zealand, or Positive Money UK. We have a monthly newsletter. We have a Facebook page. And we're looking for spokespeople in the regions. And it's being part of the solution, not part of the problem. Once you're aware of what's going on, you've got a choice. You can allow it to continue, or you can do something about it.
And just by changing to have the Reserve Bank creating our money instead of ordinary banks shouldn't drastically affect the economy. I mean, apart from improving it.
Yeah, that's right.
Talking about the changeover, I meant.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So people have said, it'll be inflationary. And that's the standard knee-jerk response. But the current situation has private overseas bank create our money supply and pump it into housing. And yet the CPI has stayed at about 2% or below for some time. And we're just saying, okay, have the Reserve Bank introduce our money rather than foreign overseas banks. It should be no more inflationary or no less inflationary. And it will certainly put the handbrake on house prices. And we will have the hospitals, we will have the roads, we will have the infrastructure, we'll have the social services that we are entitled to by way of our birthright. This is a future that will enliven and enrich New Zealand. The future we have before us using this system is more debt, more inequality, higher house prices, poor health outcomes, and it's going to get worse because the system is geared to get worse. The only way we can grow the economy is for things to get worse.
So it's over to you, listeners. We need a grassroots revolution, rather like the people in Iceland did, and they haven't got all those solutions correct yet. But I interviewed Hordur Torfason, H-O-R-D-O-R, Torfason, T-O-R-F, F-A-S-A, Torfason. So if you are listening to this online, you can Google under Green Planet FM and find Hordur Torfason talking about that, because he was the person that started things off in Iceland, and he's the person that got me really interested in all of this, and then I discovered positive money, and we went from there. But he got together, you know, a grassroots movement in Iceland, and that is absolutely what we need here in New Zealand. And Don and Positive Money, they need to lead this.
So, yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
All power to you with this.
Thanks, Lisa.
And thank you so much for driving all the way from Whakatane to come and talk to us.
My pleasure.
It's been really good.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. You've been listening to Green Planet on Planet FM. Join us at the same time next week from 8 a.m. Thursdays or anytime online at greenplanetfm.com. Now, since recording that interview, Prime Minister John Key has resigned, so we were a little out of date on a couple of things, but that occurred almost immediately after the interview concluded. But thank you very much indeed to Don Richards from Positive Money New Zealand for coming to Auckland and to be interviewed on how the banks create money out of thin air. This interview was sponsored by The Awareness Party. TheAwarenessParty.com.